This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 15th of June, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast. In Greece, tens of thousands of people take part in a general strike against budget cuts as police clash with protesters. Scientists forecast the largest ever dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
There's no oxygen in this region for large areas, large swaths of water.
And U.S. lawmakers hear testimony about a law enforcement program that allowed guns purchased in the U.S. to reach the hands of Mexican criminals.
We, the ATF, failed to fulfill one of our most fundamental obligations, to caretake the public trust, in part to keep guns out of the hands of criminals.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. missile attacks have killed 15 people in the South Waziristan region of Pakistan. The area near the border with Afghanistan has been targeted by U.S. drone attacks for months. The U.S. government says they target and often kill militants. But many Pakistanis are upset about the unauthorized attacks by a foreign military and say civilians are often among the dead. Meanwhile, the Pakistani intelligence agency has reportedly arrested 5 people believed to have served as CIA informants helping supply information on Osama bin Laden. The Syrian government has reportedly sent tanks into 2 more villages in their continuing crackdown on anti-government protests. The United Nations Human Rights Body has called for a probe into allegations of human rights abuses by Syrian authorities against their own people. The office released a report detailing the executions, torture, and targeting of activists and journalists, and the arbitrary detentions of more than 10,000 people since protests began in mid-March. Despite not being allowed inside the country to investigate, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay says they believe more than 1,100 people have been killed.
I'm gravely concerned about the human rights and humanitarian crises that the country is facing. Scores of frightened people from the town of Jisr al-Shughr and surrounding areas in the northwest of the country are crossing the Syrian-Turkish border to join thousands of others who have already fled in the past week, fearing reprisals by the security forces.
For the first time, the Arab League has spoken out against the Syrian government's actions. League Secretary General Amr Moussa said the League was angry and actively monitoring the situation and warned against continuation of the status quo. In response, the Syrian envoy to the Arab League called Moussa a traitor. Wednesday also saw thousands of people participate in a pro-government rally in Damascus, organized by the government to counteract the movement that continues to threaten the current regime. The controversial law stripping Wisconsin workers of their collective bargaining rights can now take effect, according to a new state Supreme Court ruling. Molly Stenz of WORT-FM has more from Madison.
In a 4-3 decision, the Supreme Court issued the last word on the intensely controversial legislation that has sharply divided the state since February. The ruling overturns a circuit court decision blocking the law from taking effect. The Republican-led legislature passed the law in March, but a lawsuit alleged they violated open meeting laws by holding a vote without enough advance notice. Republicans expressed relief over the court's decision. They had planned to pass the law again this week by attaching it to the state budget, but such a move was sure to draw public scrutiny. 6 Republican senators are facing recall elections later this summer for their previous votes on the bill. Assembly Speaker Jeff Fitzgerald.
From day one, we felt that we followed the procedures that we do, that this obviously was a separation of powers issue, and the court ruled in our favor. We feel great about the decision.
Democratic leaders expressed shock that the court would allow the legislature to violate their own rules. Representative Peter Barca.
Essentially, what the Supreme Court has now vested as part of Wisconsin is that the legislature is above the law.
The law will take effect within 10 days, though it's unclear when workers will begin to pay more for their benefits and pensions. Additionally, 2 other lawsuits are making their way through the courts, but are not expected to block implementation of the law this month. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
Opening statements began yesterday in Houston in a federal civil trial for a Texas woman who claimed she was gang-raped while working in Iraq for the U.S. defense contractor KBR, a former subsidiary of Halliburton. Jackson Allers has more from Houston.
Jamie Lee Jones's lawyers argued in federal court Tuesday that military contractor Kellogg Brown & Root allowed a, quote, hostile working environment for women and had a history of failing to protect workers who were sexually assaulted or harassed. Jones alleges she was gang-raped at a KBR contractor facility in 2005 and is suing KBR and its former parent company Halliburton for defrauding her. Jones's contract included a mandatory arbitration clause that said she was not allowed to take, quote, employment-related complaints to open court. Jones's testimony before Congress in 2009 over the alleged incident led to a change in federal law, barring companies from receiving government contracts if they require employees to sign an arbitration clause to resolve a range of complaints privately, including sexual assault and harassment complaints. KBR Inc. denies all of the allegations in a case that has taken 6 years to come to trial. KBR appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court to block Jones's lawsuit, but withdrew the appeal in March 2010 after Congress passed the new law. Legal sources say the trial is expected to last up to 4 weeks. Jackson Allers, FSRN, Houston, Texas.
An anti-logging activist has been found dead in the Brazilian Amazon, the fifth murder in the past month believed to be related to disputes over land and logging in the rainforest. Obede Loyla Souza was occupying unused farmland, waiting for the government to award him land in a redistribution program. Souza's body was found over the weekend with a gunshot to the head. Witnesses say he got into an argument with a logging representative in January, and recently people saw four men in a pickup truck looking for him. The watchdog group Catholic Land Pastoral says there are more than 125 activists in the region whose lives are in danger. In Libya, government forces shelled rebel groups in the mountains west of Tripoli. The rebels have reportedly seized two new towns in the last few days, moving closer to the capital, and NATO has resumed dropping bombs from aircraft in the east of the city. President Obama is under pressure to end or extend military operations in Libya. A bipartisan group of 10 lawmakers led by Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich signed on to a lawsuit filed Tuesday calling for an end to the military intervention and the spending of related funds. In a separate effort, House Speaker John Boehner gave the White House until Sunday to request congressional authorization to extend the operation in Libya. The White House is reportedly already preparing documentation to deliver to Congress. And those are today's headlines. For Free Speech Radio News, from Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. Today, across Greece, tens of thousands of people took part in the general strike, protesting the government's plan to implement new austerity measures. The country is struggling with the ongoing effects of the international financial crisis. Unemployment is high, especially among the youth, and the national debt is about 1.5 times the gross domestic product. Amateur video posted online shows protesters and police clashing at a demonstration in the capital, Athens. Socialist Prime Minister George Papandreou has promised a unity government as lawmakers debated whether to support the austerity measures demanded by the European Union and the International Monetary Fund. It's the second round of cuts by the government. These ones, worth more than $40 billion, would see more deep cuts to public sector jobs and salaries, additional taxes, and privatizations. The government says they're necessary to ensure a bailout package from the European Union worth a total of more than $150 billion and to prevent Greece from defaulting on its debts. Leo Panitch is a professor in comparative political economy at York University in Toronto. He told the Real News Network's Paul Jay that the current crisis in Greece is a direct result of draconian austerity measures implemented by the government to deal with the financial crisis that started in the United States.
There is a problem in terms of Greece's finances, but that problem existed before the crisis. It was aggravated considerably by the fact that Germany is the big exporter in Europe's free trade zone. That's what the European Union is, a free trade zone. And Greece got the money through transfers from the EU, from the European Commission for a while, but mostly from borrowing from German banks to buy German goods.
Professor Panitch says Germany's Deutsche Bank, which was heavily invested in the US mortgage market, was bailed out by the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve, and is among a number of European banks concerned that Greece may not pay back its debts, something which may be unavoidable. European finance ministers are meeting on Monday to discuss the crisis. In Washington today, U.S. House lawmakers heard testimony about a law enforcement program that allowed guns purchased in the U.S. to flow into the hands of criminals in Mexico. Matt Laszlo reports.
On December 14, 2010, Border Patrol agent Brian Terry was about to clock out of his shift and then spend the holiday with his family in Michigan. Instead, his elite unit engaged in an intense firefight that left him dead. Robert Hayer is a cousin of the deceased and was chosen to speak on behalf of the family at today's hearing before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee.
Brian did ultimately come home that Christmas. We buried him not far from the house that he was raised in just prior to Christmas Day.
Annually, U.S. purchased weapons kill many people on both sides of the U.S.-Mexican border, so that wasn't the surprising finding in the case of Terry's murder. What the family has since had to wrestle with is that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms tracked the sale of two AK-47 assault weapons found at the scene of Terry's murder and did nothing to stop them from being illegally transported. ATF agents on the ground, like Special Agent John Dodson, opposed the program, but their supervisors wouldn't listen.
Simply put, during this operation referred to as Fast and Furious, we, the ATF, failed to fulfill one of our most fundamental obligations, to caretake the public trust, in part to keep guns out of the hands of criminals.
Dodson and two of his fellow agents became whistleblowers after they realized their immediate supervisors weren't going to halt the program. They say the Fast and Furious program worked with gun dealers who suspected certain clients may be purchasing weapons on behalf of criminals. ATF agents would track these so-called straw purchasers with the intent of preventing the weapons from arming cartels in Mexico. But instead of intercepting purchasers after the sale, field agents were told to let the guns walk. Senior Special Agent Alondo James Casa oversaw part of the operation in Arizona.
On numerous occasions, the surveillance team followed straw purchasers to Phoenix area firearms dealers and would observe these straw purchasers buy and then depart with numerous firearms in hand. Those firearms included but not limited AK-47 variant rifles, 50 caliber rifles, and 5.7mm FN pistols, all of which are devastating weapons.
Agent Peter Furselli calls it a dangerous and reckless strategy. He says it amounts to ATF agents knowingly allowing guns to fall into the hands of criminals.
ATF agents allowed weapons to be provided to individuals who they knew would traffic them to members of the Mexican drug trafficking organizations. They did so by failing to lawfully interdict the weapons, and they did so by encouraging federal firearms licensees to continue selling weapons in instances where they knew that no interdiction efforts would be planned.
The chair of the Oversight Committee, Daryl Issa of California, says documents show the strategy was approved by the highest levels of the ATF.
Two of the most senior leaders in ATF, Acting Director Kenneth Melson and Acting Deputy Director Billy Hoover, were being briefed weekly on Fast and Furious. The documents show that both Melson and Hoover were keenly interested in the case and updates.
The ATF agents say they're bewildered by the goal of the program, which was to trace the guns only after they were recovered in another crime, possibly at a murder scene. With the program under investigation, Congressperson Elijah Cummings of Maryland says a major lingering question is U.S. gun policy.
No legitimate examination of this issue will be complete without analyzing our nation's gun laws, which allow tens of thousands of assault weapons to flood into Mexico from the United States every year.
A new report shows 70% of the firearms recovered from Mexican crime scenes and submitted for tracing track back to the United States. The Department of Justice denies guns were knowingly allowed to walk into Mexico. Lawmakers have subpoenas out for numerous documents relating to the Fast and Furious program. Justice Department officials say the request is pending. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
An annual forecast released Tuesday predicts the Gulf of Mexico's hypoxic or dead zone will be the largest ever recorded as a result of the flooding of the Mississippi River this spring. Scientists supported by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration say the zone could measure several thousand square miles, roughly the size of New Hampshire. The dead zone is an annual summer phenomenon in which a huge area of the Gulf loses the oxygen levels necessary to support marine life. As Zoe Sullivan reports from New Orleans, evidence shows the phenomenon's impact goes beyond the ocean floor.
It's a warm June day on Louisiana's coast. Mert Conover is leading an adult education workshop on the dead zone at the Louisiana University Marine Consortium.
We will be traveling out to Moss Bay, where we're going to pull a trawl. We have not been lucky enough to catch much lately because it's so fresh in this area. So all the brackish animals are moving further out where salinities are higher.
The water in the bay is fresher than usual because of Mississippi River flooding. But the water is also carrying nitrogen and phosphorus, chemical elements from agricultural runoff and undertreated sewage that contribute to a low oxygen area off the coast called the dead zone. Prosanta Chakrabarty studies fish at Louisiana State University.
The dead zone is this, you know, quite dramatic pollution event that happens annually. It's a constant presence, but it's an annual event where in the summer especially, the runoff from agricultural waste, from sewage waste that's coming down the Mississippi River, which is tremendous amounts of waste, enters the Gulf. There's a nutrient bloom leading to an algal bloom that consumes oxygen. So that's what the dead zone is. There's no oxygen in this region for large areas, large swaths of water.
Hypoxia is the lack of oxygen to the point that most forms of life are unable to survive. The condition is most extreme near the ocean floor and hits less mobile bottom-dwelling creatures like shrimp and oysters the hardest. But this lack of oxygen also has an impact on fish reproduction. Researchers in Texas found that the Atlantic croaker, a common Gulf fish, would not develop as many females as it would under ordinary oxygen circumstances. Croakers hatch as males by default, and some later develop ovaries and become female. Low oxygen levels inhibit this transition. Chakrabarty says this could have serious consequences for fish populations.
There's a skewed sex ratio. There's going to be a smaller number of individuals the following year. And if there's a crash due to, you know, increased fishing pressure and a crash perhaps due to this strange development females becoming males, then, you know, it's hitting it from two sides, and that's a big problem for any fish species.
The croaker is a very common and well-studied species. As a result, Chakrabarty says, it may be possible to infer similar issues with other types of fish. In the face of these concerns, advocates are pushing for changes in how the Mississippi River is managed. Matt Rota is the Science and Water Policy Director for the Gulf Restoration Network.
The Clean Water Act, I think, is a good tool to use to address some of these other issues like nitrogen phosphorus pollution. Two ways that we're really looking at that is a couple of years ago, we petitioned the EPA to do two things. One is to set numeric standards for nitrogen phosphorus pollution.
Rota says that nitrogen, which comes mostly from fertilizer, is the main driver of the dead zone. Increased corn production for ethanol has pushed up the use of nitrate fertilizers, which then run off into waterways that spill into the Mississippi River. Currently, he says, the Environmental Protection Agency allows states to monitor and control their nitrate and phosphorus runoff on a voluntary basis.
What we feel needs to be done is a TMDL, a total maximum daily load, which is something in the Clean Water Act, needs to be developed for the Gulf of Mexico. And basically what this is a pollution budget. It says it's a calculation that determines how much the river and the Gulf can take and then starts divvying up that load to the different sources of that pollution.
Gulf Coast residents want steps taken upriver to lessen the impact of fertilizers. But the leading authority on the dead zone, Dr. Nancy Rabelais, executive director of Louisiana University Marine Consortium, says that the issue is creating problems upstream, too.
Well, the issue of nutrients just is not just a Gulf of Mexico issue. There are a lot of contaminated water wells in the Midwest, contaminated drinking water. Some cities like Des Moines and Columbus, Ohio, have to put on tertiary treatment to reduce the nitrate in the drinking water, so that's a problem. There are noxious and harmful algal blooms up in the watershed because of nutrients, and many of them are toxic.
Advocates aren't the only ones who feel something needs to be done. Since the dead zone affects fishing in the Gulf, People from that industry agree that there needs to be more regulation. Cliff Hall runs the New Orleans Fish House, a seafood processor and distributor that sells about 75,000 pounds of fish every week.
I would be very much in favor of regulating what goes into the river, because no matter what point it goes into the river, it ends up here. So, you know, how many ever miles it goes up north, all of that does end up in our estuary system, and that is vital to Louisiana. It is what sets us apart from other states.
Industrial agriculture and outdated sewage plants upstream only add to the factors making it increasingly difficult to make a living in the Gulf's fishing industry. The Clean Water Act gives the federal government the tools to regulate the pollution accumulating in the Gulf, or at least to develop a national plan for river management. The Environmental Protection Agency's Hypoxia Task Force will be meeting in New Orleans in early August, and the Gulf Restoration Network hopes that its request for numeric nitrogen and phosphorus limits and the total maximum daily load requirement will receive a favorable response. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
Then you win.
I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong and ain't no longer gonna be terrorized, organized.
When a pro-democracy movement took to the streets of the Arab world in December and January, many of its youth participants brought their change-inspiring music with them.
Yalla. Al-hip-hop al-masri, al-ajnabi.
Nigerian musician Fela Kuti said that music is the weapon of the future, and the critical lyrics and homegrown beats of Arab hip-hop played their own role in the so-called Arab Spring uprisings. FSRN plans to produce a documentary on the connection between hip-hop and the Arab uprisings, but we need your help. Visit fsrn.org to find out how you can support this project, Arab Hip-Hop, a soundtrack to the Arab Spring. Immigrants' rights activist Carlos Montes is due to appear in a Los Angeles court Thursday on charges relating to a firearms violation. The charges come after a May 17th FBI raid of his home. Civil rights group the Committee to Stop FBI Repression says Montes is being targeted by the FBI for his anti-war and immigrant rights activism. The group is calling for a national day of action tomorrow to coincide with Montes' court appearance. This comes as the New York Times reports the FBI plans to expand the powers of agents targeting U.S. citizens in surveillance operations. For more on his situation, Carlos Montes joins us now. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
What exactly are you charged with, and how are you pleading to these charges?
I was arrested on a charge dealing with a firearm code, and I was released on bail. And I've done nothing wrong. I'm going to fight all the charges. This is a pretext that they used to raid my house, knock down my door, and ransack all my political files, take my computer and my cell phones, and go through all my Chicano civil rights movement files dating back over 40 years, ransacking my files dealing with my current political activities in the immigrant rights movement, the anti-war movement, and the educational justice movement.
Tell us a little bit more about your current activism and why you think that might have made you a target.
Yes, I'm currently active with Fight Back News, in fighting against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also denouncing U.S. policy against the Palestinian people, as well as in Colombia. So I also was one of the organizers of the massive demonstration at the RNC in September of 2008, where we denounced the Bush-McCain warmongers. This is why I'm under attack, and why we're currently under investigation by the federal grand jury out of Chicago, looking into our anti-war activities. I'm also a longtime immigrant rights activist, and you know, I fight for immigration reform, but I denounced the U.S. policies of NAFTA and intervention in Latin America, which causes mass migration. I just don't see it as a civil rights issue. I see it as a policy where U.S. intervention causes the displacements of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people throughout Latin America and throughout the world.
That raid on your home on May 17 came the day before a Committee to Stop FBI Repression press conference announcing the discovery of secret FBI documents that they say link the investigation into you with two other activists. Can you tell us a little bit more about those documents and what's in them?
The documents left by the FBI and at home in Minnesota dealt with the operational manual dealing of specifically how to deal with a raid at a home, and also in terms of what type of military and police tactics to use, what type of firearms, what type of backup, but also had a long list of questions to ask the folks being targeted dealing with their political views and their political activities. The fact that the FBI was in my home and attempted to question me while I was handcuffed in the backseat of a police car clearly shows that this is part of the FBI attack on not only myself, but on the anti-war activists in Chicago and Minnesota, throughout the Midwest and the South.
You have a long history of activism, and you've been telling us a little bit about that. You were targeted by the FBI back in the 1960s and 70s as a co-founder of the Brown Berets and as an anti-Vietnam War activist. How's this current case against you different to what you were experiencing back in the 1960s?
Well, it's very similar. The only thing that's different about it is that they're targeting a wide range of activists, from the Midwest to Southern California. They're targeting women, they're targeting union activists, students, as well as anti-war activists and immigrant rights activists. Back in the 60s, the counterintelligence program targeted specifically the Black Panther Party, the Brown Berets, the Black Liberation Movement, and the Chicano Liberation Movement, as well as the American Indian Movement.
So what would you like to see done to stop what you say is a campaign of targeting activists by the FBI?
Well, we're demanding that the drop the charges in my case, but that they stop the attacks on all the activists, that they stop the harassment, that they return all property, and that they cease and desist from harassing us and investigating us, but also that they end the federal grand jury witch hunt that's orchestrated out of Chicago.
What do you expect to be the result of your appearance in court on June 16?
Well, we will, this is my first appearance in court, we will demand that they hand over any type of documents or evidence or allegations that they have on me. All they've done is charge me with a firearm code violation. So we will be in court to demand that they release any pertinent documents in my case and to move to get the charges dropped.
Carlos Montes, activist and member of Latinos Against War, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Shannon Young. Headlines editor, Andrew Stelzer. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Scott Pham and Jane Chang. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.